Asian countries have slowed down the spread of the coronavirus. One factor, getting everybody to wear a mask.
I only take off my mask whenever I have my lunch or dinner.
Also, China wants to help other countries hit by the coronavirus. Beijing is sending lots of medical supplies to Europe. The help is badly needed. But many say Beijing is not acting just for altruistic reasons.
They see this as a moment when China is in a good position to actually elevate its global standing.
And a first-time voter in Florida wonders how the government can provide so much money to help struggling businesses.
But not enough to provide for testing kits and research.
Young Latinos reconsider their votes during a pandemic. Those stories and more today here on The World. Let's begin with a couple of stats today. More Americans have now died from the coronavirus outbreak than in the September 11th terror attacks. Worldwide, the death toll has topped 40,000. On the economic front, global stock markets seem to have calmed down. Not too far up, not too far down. For market watchers, it's getting used to the new normal. One other promising story, China seems to have turned the corner in slowing the spread of the disease. It's now stepping up to help other countries. But not everybody is thrilled about that. The World's Sarah Birnbaum explains.
If you turn on the TV in China or go online, you'll see stuff like this everywhere. This is footage from state television of a medical team in China's Anhui province about to set off for Italy. They're going to help fight the coronavirus. Over the past few weeks, China has sent masks, ventilators, test kits, and teams of doctors to countries around the world. And in the process, the People's Republic is assuming a role that the U.S. used to occupy during pandemics, conflicts, and natural disasters. Dolly Yang, a political science professor at the University of Chicago, says China wants to be seen as a good actor on the world stage.
The Chinese government has been very, very proactive in reaching out to different governments.
Early this year, when the virus was running rampant in Wuhan and just starting to spread to the rest of the country, China's government accepted medical supplies from almost 80 different countries. And now Yang says China wants to pay it forward.
The Chinese government, it was very grateful for the help that it received in January, February in particular. And now, of course, it also has the energy and also the resources and also a lot of experiences now to share with the rest of the world.
But beyond that, do Communist Party leaders in Beijing have other reasons for wanting to play the role of global good neighbor? Of course they do, says Dexter Roberts. He's the author of The Myth of Chinese Capitalism.
They see this as a moment when China is in a good position to actually elevate its global standing.
Roberts says it's about exercising soft power, spreading influence, and reworking the geopolitical status quo. China's been working on these things for years. But one thing about China's current global moment that cannot be overlooked, says Roberts, is how it stands in strong contrast to Europe and especially to the U.S.
So I think they do see this as a real opportunity to say, look, you know, we successfully dealt with the virus. The Western model hasn't done a very good job so far. And this means that we're a model to be emulated.
And there are signs that the strategy is working. In Serbia, President Aleksandar Vučić recently blasted the EU and said the only country he could rely on during this pandemic was China.
Evropska solidarnost ne postoji.
European solidarity does not exist, Vučić says. That was just a fairy tale. The Serbian president went on to call Chinese leader Xi Jinping his friend and brother. This audio, by the way, is from a video clip of Vučić that's been running on CGTN, the Chinese state-run TV network. I also found this video online put out by Serbian officials for Chinese social media.
The embassy of the People's Republic of China was the first to approach us and offer help. The support of China saved lives in Serbia.
Carrie Allen monitors Chinese language media for the BBC. She says the state-run news outlets have been chock full of this stuff.
People in China are just hearing constantly about Serbia, probably more than any other country, because there is such an overdrive of appreciation.
It's not just Serbia, Alan says. News consumers in China are hearing all about how their government has done a better job responding to the pandemic than a certain world leader.
China has really been just picking up on every criticism that Donald Trump has been receiving, and it's been sharing them in its local media to show that there's anger about the way that he's responding to this.
China's public relations efforts at home and abroad are also aimed at tearing down the idea that Beijing deserves blame for the coronavirus outbreak. Here's Dexter Roberts again.
When you look at what happened in China, you have initially this, in effect, a cover-up, which was devastating.
COVID-19 cases were underreported, whistleblowers were silenced, and early on, Xi Jinping was nowhere to be found. But that's not the story Chinese leaders are telling now.
The first thing they want to do is make their own population, the people in China, forget about this disastrous blunder at the beginning of the virus, and instead focus on the second part, which has been quite impressive.
And in one sense, at least, President Trump is doing the same thing. After downplaying the threat of the outbreak at first, Trump has gone out of his way to praise his administration and himself for doing what he describes as a great job. For the world, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
So how is the COVID-19 outbreak already reshuffling global politics? To take a look at that, I'm joined by Nicholas Burns, former ambassador to NATO. Burns is also an unpaid advisor to the Joe Biden campaign and editor-in-chief of The Economist, Zanny Minton-Beddoes.
I am struck as much by the absence of U.S. leadership as I am by what China has been doing. We're in a world where multilateralism has become, in some sense, a bit of a dirty word. Globalism is a dirty world. It's a much more nationalistic world. And the U.S. was taking a different tack with a trade war and so forth long before this pandemic. But now, in the teeth of this pandemic, at a time when you really, really need big picture global cooperation, we just haven't got that. And it strikes me most powerfully, actually, when I look at what's happening in emerging economies, whether it's India, whether it's South Africa, whether it's places in the world which do not have the health systems that we have in the West, the economies are going to be hammered. And ordinarily, there would be a sort of big multilateral response to that. And that seems to be completely absent. There isn't any real global leadership on this.
Well, Nick, how do other countries see the U.S. right now in the midst of this pandemic?
I think, unfortunately, a lot of countries believe that the United States could lead and should lead, but won't lead. There has to be a global response to this. Countries have to share data on the infection so that we can model the crisis accurately and understand it. Countries have to work on a vaccine together and how to distribute it equitably. The G20, the group of the 20 largest countries of the world, is probably the right forum. They met for 2 hours last week in a teleconference. That means everybody gave a 10-minute speech and they went home. There's no sense that they're working together. And I think President Trump has been entirely deficient as a leader. Where is the simple expression of sympathy for the people of Italy from the president of the United States or the people of Spain or the people of South Korea? That kind of thing goes a long way, human sympathy.
Zanny, I mean, the U.S. has seemingly abdicated its role as that world leader, but is there a space for the U.S. to step back into that role?
The U.S. is still seen by many around the world as the natural global leader. That hasn't gone away yet and isn't sort of dissipating completely. And secondly, China is viewed somewhat suspiciously, and China itself does not want to step into this role of real responsible global leader. China has a much more self-interested in the short-term sense of its role. I don't sense any desire to play that responsible global hegemon role. And so what we have is a vacuum, and a vacuum that can be filled if the US chooses to fill that again. I think around the world that would be welcomed with absolutely open arms. And so, no, I don't think it's too late at all.
If there is a deep and damaging global recession, even a depression, help us understand what that might mean for both the US and China. Nick?
President Xi and President Trump certainly have to worry about their own people if we end up in a depression. But we also have to do the right thing and not repeat the mistakes of 80 years ago in the 1930s, when in the wake of the economic collapse, countries built high walls around each other and they raised tariffs. This is a time actually for countries to lower barriers to trade so that the very important products made, say, in China can get to the United States or Britain or South Africa when they need to, or medicines or chemicals important for the pharmaceutical industry can actually get to source. This requires leadership. President Trump seems to believe that we're weaker when we work with others, that we're stronger when we act singularly, and he's completely wrong in that assessment, and it's really damaging us.
Zanny, we're kind of looking at this as China and the U.S. Where does Europe stand on all of this? And is there any place on the continent where they might step into the breach?
The Europeans are not really working at a European Union level together. Although the European Central Bank has done a huge amount, there hasn't been as much solidarity within the members of the euro area as yet that you would expect. And I think quite often now the conversation falls into two extremes. Either there are some who for a long while were saying, this will be a big, big plunge, and then we'll have a V-shaped recovery, everything will bounce back, and we'll get back to normal. Or there was the very, very gloomy, this will precipitate a depression. What I think is most likely is something in the middle. It is increasingly clear that we are not one day suddenly going to say, we're able to lift all of the restrictions, all of the social distancing, we're back to normal straight away. It will be an iterative process, probably at a different pace in different parts of the country, in different countries, depending on how much use is made of testing, depending on how much use is made of technology to understand where there are hotspots. And the sharing of that information, the sharing of best practice, working together to come up with the optimal way to balance this question of health and how you can open the economy, I think that's the real key to this having the minimum possible economic damage, which will be huge, but the minimum possible. And the other is how governments have reacted and what ways governments support their economies.
Nick, what is your most likely scenario for what the new world order would look like post-COVID-19?
Unfortunately, I think we're going to see a lot of people react against globalization, against global supply chains. You'll see companies back off undue reliance on China, either for trade purposes or because in a pandemic like this, you simply can't get what you need to manufacture. That will be one. We're certainly seeing a resurgence of nationalism, perverse nationalism, discriminatory nationalism. We saw Viktor Orban, the leader of Hungary, become effectively an autocrat yesterday and suspending parliament and suspending civil liberties. We're going to see in a way, the ugly side of human nature.
I am somewhat more optimistic because I think that we are unlikely to see as big of a change permanently in the world that some people worry about. I think there will be some reinforcement of the unwinding of supply chains of the sort that was, frankly, that was happening before because of the trade war. But I do think there are other areas where we're going to see really positive developments. I think it's going to be very, very hard now to eliminate sick pay in the United States. I think there will be a sense of needing to invest in healthcare systems, which is much more acute now than it was 6 months ago. My main thought on the post-COVID-19 world is that it was a world without real leadership beforehand, and I think it's going to be a world without real leadership afterwards.
Zanny Minton-Beddoes, the editor-in-chief of The Economist, and Nicholas Burns, former ambassador to NATO. Thank you both very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're with the world. Americans watch the numbers of new coronavirus infections and fatalities rising every day. In other countries, there are signs of hope. Singapore, South Korea, and Taiwan are three places where the spread of COVID-19 is slowing down a lot. What have they done differently? Well, there's no short answer to that question, but as the world's Patrick Wynn reports, getting everybody to wear a mask is one factor.
A few weeks ago, Fox and Friends turned to the top doctor in America and asked him this.
Doctor, you're saying stop using masks because unless you've got the coronavirus, you shouldn't be wearing it, right?
Absolutely.
Absolutely, says the Surgeon General Jerome Adams, who has tweeted, seriously, people, stop buying masks. On Fox and Friends, he doubled down, saying masks actually make the outbreak worse.
Folks who don't know how to wear them properly tend to touch their faces a lot and actually can increase the spread of coronavirus. You can increase your risk of getting it by wearing a mask if you are not a healthcare provider.
Basically, the message in the U.S. has been, if you're not a doctor or a nurse, forget about the mask. And that sounds really strange here in Asia, where in many cities, wearing a mask is seen as a moral duty for everyone, not just hospital workers. One of China's top doctors is a man named George Gao, and he just came out and said, quote, the big mistake in the U.S. and Europe is that people aren't wearing masks. China takes this seriously, Officials there have even used drones with loudspeakers to fly around and scold anyone who is outside without a mask. Places like Hong Kong, South Korea, Taiwan, they also promote universal masking. And the vibe is not so much, I must protect myself, and more like, oh no, what if I've got the coronavirus and I infect other people?
It's more to prevent spread of the disease rather than to prevent receiving the disease.
That's Linfa Wang, a renowned expert on infectious diseases based in Singapore. Now, the World Health Organization still says that you don't need to wear a mask if you're not showing symptoms. But Dr. Wang says, look, we know infected people often don't show symptoms. So why not just stick a mask on everyone?
I know in certain societies, it's hard, right? Other people are less educated or economically in a different stage or less obedient as a society.
He didn't single out America, but when I talk to other experts, I keep hearing that Americans need to do universal masking, like yesterday.
I think everyone going out should wear a mask.
That is another infectious diseases specialist, Dr. Joseph Zhang, in Hong Kong. And he's masked up basically all day, putting on a new one every 4 hours.
I only take off my mask whenever I have my lunch or dinner.
But he's a doctor, and they're the ones who really need masks, right? Yes, and right now, hospitals in the U.S. are pleading with the federal government to get them more high-quality masks. There's a shortage, and for now, masks should go to nurses over random people. This is one of the reasons why the Surgeon General tells the public to stop buying masks. But here's the thing. Taiwan, South Korea, when this outbreak started there, they had shortages too. So their government stepped in to boost the supply of masks so every citizen could get one. America hasn't done that. And Dr. Zhang wants to know, even if every American had a mask, would they wear them?
The difference in the perception of the mask comes down to the cultural norms about covering your face.
When very few people wear masks, he says, putting one on makes it seem like you're sick, like saying, look at me, I'm infected. But when everyone wears one, you feel like, oh, we're all in this together. And societies can change. Before 2003, Dr. Zhang says Hong Kong was more like America. Hardly anyone wore masks unless they were ill. But then they got hit by an earlier strain of coronavirus.
We have a very painful lesson from 2003 SARS happened in Hong Kong.
SARS. One of those painful lessons, Zhang says, is that everyone should have put on masks as soon as that virus hit. And it's a mistake, he says, they won't make again. For the World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
In the Gaza Strip, roughly 2 million Palestinians are squeezed into a small territory. It's very dense, and it's hard to practice social distancing there. Add lots of smokers, high rates of obesity, and stress-related disorders. Gaza's population appears especially vulnerable to the coronavirus. Dr. Yehia Abed is an epidemiologist in Gaza. He says so far the number of reported cases there is low, but he's worried that conditions in Gaza will allow the coronavirus to spread quickly.
The 10 cases which we detected are asymptomatic. No fever, no cough. And that will make me worry that if there is other asymptomatic cases among the population, Gaza Strip is one of the highly dense area in the world. In this case, the hazard of the spread of the infection will be dangerous in Gaza Strip.
Right, and Gaza is suffering from a severe shortage in medical equipment, only 60 ventilators for roughly 2 million people. So how are local health officials hoping to contain the spread of the coronavirus and keep it from overwhelming, as you say, this very densely populated territory and an already shattered health system?
Suppose that, and I hope not, suppose that the infection spread in Gaza, the system only could deal with the mild cases only, but not with the severe cases.
If you and other medical professionals are unable to treat the most severe cases, will you just turn them away?
Yeah, listen, look for the experience of Italy. What's happened there in Italy? why the mortality rate in Italy jumped up more than 10% case fatality there? Not because the Italian health system is weak, no. Simply because the Italian healthcare system could not cope with the number of the cases who are coming in one time. And this is the most worrying thing for me as Palestinian here in Gaza. I hope that what's happened in Italy is not repeated here in Gaza.
We hope the same for you. When we're talking medical supplies and what the health system in Gaza needs to handle an outbreak of COVID-19, how are Gaza's needs different from other places?
In Gaza, it seems to me that no large difference than what is going on in the other world. Mm. It seems to me that we have good staff, we have good experts who could work. In reality, they are deprived of the facilities to conduct excellent work inside Gaza. People are committed for their work, and I am looking that the world will look for this blocked area that suffered in the last 14 years from continuous siege to support the conditions of 2 million people that are suffering nowadays in Gaza.
Dr. Yehia Abed is an epidemiologist and teaches public health at Al-Quds University near Jerusalem. Doctor, thank you very much for the view from Gaza. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
News headlines are coming up. You're with the world. For sports fans, this is a dark time, but we'll survive. Consider ancient Mesoamerican societies where a game ball was like a god.
The movement of the ball itself in these ball games had very deep cosmological significance. You know, it was actually sort of seen as the rising and setting of the sun.
3,000 years ago, that ball bounced around a court just discovered in Mexico. That's ahead here on The World. Spain is now approaching 100,000 cases of coronavirus, third most in the world. The health emergency chief, Fernando Simon, himself tested positive. He's been offering remote updates on the pandemic via video. Today, Simon said there are signs that Spain's infection rate is slowing down, and the aim now, he said, is to avoid the collapse of intensive care units. That means slowing the spread of disease and keeping medical staff protected. About 1 in 7 of Spain's COVID-19 cases are healthcare workers. Another grim stat from Spain, it now has the world's second highest death toll from the outbreak and not enough cold storage to safeguard cadavers. Jen Omani has this update from Madrid, a city that's been dramatically transformed in recent days.
Corinne Pira has worked as a pediatric nurse in Madrid's busy Ramón y Cajal hospital for 30 years, but she has never seen anything like this. At the end of another long shift in one of Europe's worst affected cities, she says the anger and impotence she feels flow out in the shower when she finally allows herself to cry.
You get in the shower and you feel so frustrated that you start to shed all the tears that you can't shed at the hospital because you can't cry there because tears are also a source of contamination.
Madrid's health workers are in danger, Corinne says. She is given one mask a week with proper filters, which reeks of sweat after shifts spent running between rooms of patients with COVID-19.
We don't have protective equipment. We're supposed to have protective kits, like with the plastic apron and then another one made of paper, every time we walk into a patient's room. But we don't have enough of the plastic ones. So what we're supposed to do is put them in a paper bag, putting ourselves at risk so they can recycle them.
Patients arriving with almost any other illness are turned away, and the children she was used to treating are being diverted to other hospitals. She worries constantly about newborns with genetic illnesses and whether they are being treated quickly enough to stop brain damage. But the most distressing thing about her job, Pira says, is the silence of the patients.
There's two patients in every room, and they don't speak to each other. I think they feel like they're bad, like they've done something wrong. They've done this to their families and to society. It's like they think it's their fault that they have this illness.
The 18 nurses on her ward are now reduced to 12. Six of her colleagues have COVID-19, and one has contracted the pneumonia typical of serious cases. Although Pira is used to suffering in her line of work, the toll seems unbearably high. As hospitals battle chaos, Madrid's morgues are also overwhelmed, so the government has come up with a controversial solution. It's housing corpses awaiting burial and cremation at the Ice Palace, a popular skating rink in the east of the city. In normal times, the Ice Palace is a place where parents watch their kids take tentative glides on the rink, where teenagers from the local high school flirt in the food court. Now, dozens of coffins cover the ice. Francisco Sanchez Robles is the rink manager. He's trying hard to remember the space as it was.
Well, every weekend the rink would hold training sessions for our skating teams. Then we'd also have classes. And then it would open up to the public for leisure skating.
The Ice Palace is located in a shopping mall, which also includes a supermarket. Cheerful tunes play across the aisles, though the rest of the mall is eerily quiet and shuttered.
Normally, families come here. They come here with their kids to ice skate, little kids and teenagers. And now, well, we find ourselves with this problem.
This is Clemente Ramon, who is picking up groceries at the supermarket. His own children used to skate at the Ice Palace. He just can't believe there's nowhere else in Madrid that can hold the city's dead.
It's not the right place for this. We also have a conference center close to here that they have turned into a field hospital. And I just feel there are places that are more suited to this problem, not right here in a city neighborhood.
Francisco Sanchez Robles, the manager of the rink, has no idea when he will be able to welcome families back to the Ice Palace. Some skaters might think twice before gliding across a rink used for such a grim purpose. But he remains hopeful.
There will be people who will be reluctant, but time smooths out everything. Time heals.
With Madrid turned upside down by coronavirus, the only thing left to do is wait. For The World, Jennifer Omani in Madrid.
Here's a problem with COVID-19, practicing social distancing when you just can't get away from other people. That's a reality for roughly 70 million people worldwide living in crowded refugee camps. Douglas Herman spends a lot of his time at the Moria refugee camp on the Greek island of Lesbos. He's the co-founder of Refocus Media Labs, a nonprofit that teaches photography and filmmaking to refugees, a way to share their stories. Douglas, it's kind of stunning that just a few weeks ago, the concern for refugees was actually getting space at Moria and moving on to Europe. Now we're looking at how to protect refugees from coronavirus. What restrictions are in place at the Moria refugee camp?
Well, the Moria refugee camp now is essentially on full lockdown. Residents are not allowed to leave. For 2 weeks now, you were not allowed to leave outside of 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., and now they're making it even more difficult for anyone to leave. So they're essentially pushing it towards a total stay inside the camp at all times.
And how much access do NGOs and aid groups have to the refugees in the camp? I mean, what do we know for sure about coronavirus in camps like Moria?
It's become very difficult for anyone to access the space unless you are a medical providing NGO prior to the new measures inside the camp. You have zero access. So right now, those that are remaining on the island have been working in shifts to provide medical supports from 8 a.m. until 3 p.m. Monday through Friday. But there's nothing at night and there's no services on the weekends. And there are less than 20 medics on the island right now. In the weeks leading up to the announcement of coronavirus protocols, there was extreme violence against NGO workers on the island for weeks, which was unaddressed by the local authorities, which forced a lot of NGOs to send their volunteers home. Now the borders are closed completely, so no one can come in, and anyone who was left on the island is now, you know, overstretched. You're looking at less than 20 medical volunteers and over 20,000 residents.
What are you hearing or seeing from those photography students of yours? Is there anything that kind of provides you a better picture of what's going on?
Yeah, they're documenting the situation every day, and the crazy reality is that nothing has really changed in terms of the day-to-day life for a resident of the camp. Everyone is still forced into very overcrowded environments to wait on food lines. Water is very, very difficult to have at a 24/7 clip. So the water is off in many, many instances for hours at a time, which then leads to giant crowds and overcrowding for people to try to fill up water bottles when it does come back on. Now that people can't leave the camp, you have even more of a congestion in the common areas where people are walking to go to a market to buy something. And now, because of the supply chain challenges that Mori is facing, much like every other place in the world, you now have a shortage of foods, which then means that they have to wait on the lines for sometimes 2 to 3 hours more than once or twice a day just to find food to feed their families. So generally speaking, everyone at all times in the day is constantly put into crowded areas, and it's impossible to practice social distancing.
Douglas, have you heard about any strategies that officials are considering or have already taken to at least slow the spread of the virus in camps like Moria?
The grim reality is that at the current moment, the biggest impact has been from the residents themselves, who are putting up signs in multiple languages to ensure that the residents understand what they're supposed to do in terms of washing their hands, avoiding crowds, staying at home, trying to self-isolate, or to see a doctor. But the means with which to do these things that everyone else is being advised to do to, you know, flatten the curve is impossible to do inside the camp. You basically have any NGOs that were left on the ground still working inside the camp. They're the ones who are making the soap or making makeshift do-it-yourself masks or distributing posters or walking around with megaphones to communicate to people who are illiterate about what they need to do to protect themselves. But we still, sadly, do not see a concerted effort from the authorities to protect the population inside. They're terrified because they recognize that no one is testing anyone. So right now we have essentially a false negative report of zero confirmed cases inside the camp. We've already had 4 confirmed cases on the island of Lesbos, 1 death. All of those cases are from Greek locals, but they're scared, and they should be, because there aren't any measures being put in place to protect them. And the psychological impact as a result of seeing nothing change on the ground is unbelievable. I mean, I hear them constantly saying that their lives don't count, that somehow they're less than the rest of the people in Europe, and how are we supposed to survive this? If this comes through here, what are we supposed to do? They feel completely exposed.
Douglas Herman is the co-founder of Refocus Media Labs, telling us about the coronavirus situation at Moria refugee camp in Greece. It is good to have you with us, Douglas, and good to have your students' eyes on the ground as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
On a typical spring Tuesday in a presidential election year, voters head to the polls, but primaries are being postponed. Votes are being conducted by mail. Political rallies are gone. But this doesn't mean voters are not thinking about who to send to Washington. We've been featuring a series here we're calling Every 30 Seconds, because every 30 seconds a Latino turns old enough to vote. They're becoming a huge voting bloc. Today, reporter Alejandra Martinez from WLRN in Miami tells us about one young voter in South Florida and how the coronavirus is impacting her decisions.
Janelis Ayuso is trying to cope with the new reality of coronavirus.
It's definitely a stressful time for me and my family.
That's from a voice memo Janelis sent to Update Me. Janelis' family's financial situation has changed.
My mom just got laid off from her job, and right now we're kind of just figuring out how we're going to be able to navigate this global pandemic for the next coming weeks and figure out what we're going to do about money and supplies.
Janelis and I actually met for the first time a few weeks ago, before the city of Miami shut down all public places due to the outbreak.
Hey, I'm Alejandra.
Janelis,
so nice to meet you in person.
Nice to meet you.
Janelis is 18, Cuban Puerto Rican, and identifies as non-binary, meaning Janelis goes by the pronouns they and them. They has bright red hair, wears huge hoop earrings, and bulky pink glasses. Because of that, Janelis goes by pink.
bright aerial mermaid hair.
We talked about politics and issues important to them.
Human rights, race, immigration, women's rights, farm workers and domestic workers' rights.
Pink grew up in Wynwood, a Miami neighborhood formerly known as
El Barrio or Little San Juan.
Right now, Pink's a high school senior. Pink says they became more aware of the issues affecting the community about a year ago.
People of color and black people and indigenous people had to struggle through in order to be where they are now. I think for so long I had all the words to talk about the problems and none to come up with the solutions.
That year, Pink joined a Miami social justice group called Dream Defenders. Pink's mentor, Quanisha Smith, remembers meeting them for the first time.
She was a little shy. I was like, okay, I see something in you.
With guidance from Smith, Pink gained confidence. Pink started canvassing and throwing voter parties.
And she was just in a place like, I want to know more and I want to grow. And like she saw our fellowship as being a tool and a path for her to be able to do that.
Dream Defenders has about 80 members. They're Black and brown and young. With Dream Defenders, Pink led initiatives to increase youth engagement. Smith says youth like Pink care about their rights.
They are engaged. They see what their parents had to go through to get here, right? And that reality of like, oh, because of my status, certain things that I can't do.
Important issues for Pink are healthcare, student debt, and immigration.
People who come here deserve to live dignified lives, whether they have papers or not. Like, borders are whack.
And even more now with the spread of this coronavirus.
Our healthcare system is completely broken, and the way that the government finds trillions of dollars to bail out banks but not enough to provide for testing kits and research and all the things that we so desperately need right now is just really telling of the empire that we live in.
Pink is ready for this year's presidential election and will be voting for the first time. Even with the coronavirus pandemic, politics is still something that's on Pink's mind.
I'm definitely thinking of politics all the time. I'm waiting to see what happens in the upcoming week.
Pink's paying close attention to Senator Bernie Sanders and his campaign. Sanders lost the Florida primaries to Vice President Joe Biden.
If Biden wins the primary, I will not be voting. Just as simple as that.
For now, Pink can get out the vote like before through voter campaigns. Miami is a ghost town, and people are urged to stay at home. So to pass the time, when they are not working on their online classes, Pink writes poetry as they wait for the November election.
When you are old enough to understand...
In this poem, Janaylee Sayuso, also known as Pink, writes to their future daughter about hope.
To show you what revolutionary love looks like.
For the world, I'm Alejandra Martinez in Miami.
Developing countries hit by COVID-19 are struggling. Unlike the U.S., many of them can't just pass a stimulus package. But $14 billion will soon be coming their way. As the world's Rupa Shenoy explains, the aid isn't just for governments. It will also go to private companies.
The $14 billion comes from an organization designed to help the world work together just at times like these. The World Bank was created at a conference in the mountains of New Hampshire in 1944. Its purpose was to help rebuild European countries devastated by World War II.
These meetings are designed to promote trade in the post-war world and to create a foundation for lasting peace.
Over the years, the World Bank grew into one of the largest sources of funding for projects aimed at reducing poverty. In 2018, it partnered with the World Health Organization to create the Global Preparedness Monitoring Board. The board's first report, released last year, concluded that the world remained unprepared for a global pandemic. And then a pandemic hit.
What the World Bank is doing is working to provide a fast, flexible response based on developing country needs.
That's the World Bank Group President David Malpass talking about the emergency funding package approved by its board in response to the coronavirus.
The speed and breadth of the response is crucial to its effectiveness.
It includes $6 billion to help developing countries set up health clinics and buy gloves, masks, and portable ventilators. Another $8 billion goes to a separate arm of the World Bank that invests in the private sector of developing nations. It's called the International Finance Corporation, or IFC. Philippe Leroux is its chief executive officer.
As you know, when there is a crisis like this of this magnitude, what happens is a lot of companies are in trouble. So we're trying everything we can to soften the blow there.
The IFC is making loans available to businesses through banks across the world. In less than 10 days, 315 companies came forward to ask for help. Leroux says his staff has been given the authority to go ahead with projects without getting approval from their board.
We can save about 4 to 6 weeks by not going to our board.
He says they're already thinking about the next phase, when the pandemic starts to recede.
The key is that what do we do to make sure that we accelerate the recovery?
So IFC staff is also getting ready to help companies restructure and develop new projects for investment. They're finding virtual ways to supervise and do appraisals of projects, all while isolated in their own homes across 170 countries, many with their children, and many on call 24/7.
Because it's a world issue, it's a global issue. We're all in it together. This is why we were created.
This is why worldwide partnerships exist, Lovrieux says. So in times of crisis, we have a way to work together and help each other. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
If you think the basketball court at your local Y is old, get a load of this. Archaeologists have uncovered a ball court in the mountains of Oaxaca in Mexico. It's over 3,000 years old. Not only that, researchers think this ball court could shed light on how Mesoamerican societies developed thousands of years ago. Jeff Blomster is an archaeologist at George Washington University.
The ball game was fundamental in many aspects of Mesoamerica society. You know, we actually have documents from the Aztecs and the Spanish invaders who talk about how sometimes conflicts between city-states were actually resolved by a ball game. And we know that the movement of the ball itself in these ball games had very deep cosmological significance. You know, it was actually sort of seen as the rising and setting of the sun.
So I know these kinds of ball courts, or ball courts in general, are not uncommon in the ruins across the Mesoamerican world. You find them in ruins in Guatemala and Honduras. What is the game that would have been played on this court in Oaxaca?
Most of my colleagues think that the one that definitely needed a ball court was some version of what we call the hip ball game, where the rubber ball was hit off the hip and often into the architecture of the court itself. So to me, finding an architectural ball court suggests that it could have actually been a place where the hip ball game was played. And in some ways, that's confirmed by these figurines that we found. You know, we found figurines that show ball players, and they're consistently wearing these sort of wide belts or hip protectors, something that we call in later Mesoamerican societies yokes. The fact that these ball player figurines are consistently wearing this costume might support the idea that this might have been an early version of the hip ball game that was played in the Atlatongo ball court.
I mean, there is a tight connection between sports and society. Do you think this ball court and whatever game was played on it, how did it influence the way the society around Oaxaca developed?
I think that this was actually very important in these changes in society. So you probably have individuals in society, nascent leaders, aggrandizers, whatever you want to call them, who are essentially finding ways of having more influence, more power in society than their companions. At Latongo, where you do have a society that we're starting to see the emergence of these more socio-politically complex phenomenon, you may have a sort of a nascent leader who actually was able to direct the construction of these ball courts. And then probably who was able to both integrate society in the sense that people, support teams, they come to see games. But at the same time, it also excluded some people because, certain individuals are deciding who plays and who actually sees these games. Because the reality is these ball courts aren't so large that everybody in this community could have actually been spectators.
So would the game have kind of facilitated contact between communities? Would there be like a traveling team?
I think it certainly would have facilitated communication. And my question now is, where are the other ball courts from this time period? They must be out there.
Jeff Blomster, an archaeologist at George Washington University, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for taking the time.
Our new reality is inspiring all kinds of new music. Here's another song prompted by the pandemic, this one from a Spanish singer we're a big fan of, Manu Chao. The title translates as, I dreamt of another world.
Soñé otro mundo tan lejos y tan cerca. Soñé otro viaje, cuatro caminos, cinco destinos. Soñé la risa, soñé la ilusión.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
Soñé de un amor de noche y de día, soñé la fortuna, soñé la alegría, soñé de mi luna que no se rendía y que a mi gato le decía. Ajá. Calavera no llora, serenata de amor. Calavera no llora, no tiene corazón.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.